Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Immigration Judge Quotas conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Greg Chen, Director of Government Relations for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and welcome to everybody who has joined our call here, entitled Immigration Law Experts Discussing the Detrimental Quotas Imposed by the Administration on Immigration Judges. And in a moment, I will be introducing our three esteemed speakers who will be addressing this topic. Let me begin by just mentioning some specifics here. So it was just on Monday of this past week that news broke that the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which controls the immigration court system and is part of the Department of Justice, that they have instituted through policies and guidelines to the immigration judges strict quotas that will be part of the individual judges' actual performance evaluations. And these quotas will be what their performance will be measured by. AILA issued a press statement yesterday expressing deep concern about this move. Our concern is that this new policy and practice will strip away the independence held by judges who are making critical decisions about people's lives and specifically about whether they will be deported. In addition, we are concerned that it is going to erode the fundamental due process to which people are entitled who are going through the removal and deportation process. A couple of logistics here before I go into introducing the speakers. We will be recording this as an audio recording, and our communications team, Bellwoods and George Tamaris, will be sending information out about that afterwards. Also, as resources for you, AILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, has issued a press statement about that yesterday, which will be made available to you. Also, the National Association of Immigration Judges has issued a statement, which we can also make sure is available to you. All our resources will be available on our website, and we have a specific resource page on the immigration courts and the fast-breaking developments in that area. So without further ado, the three speakers we have, first is Judge Ashley Tabador of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She's been an immigration judge since 2005 and currently is the president of NAIJ. Judge Tabador has served as a U.S. attorney in California, and also as an adjunct professor at the University of Southern California Law School. She is a graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, as well as UC Hastings College of Law. Our second speaker is Jeremy McKinney, who is the National Secretary for AILA. He's a practicing attorney in immigration law in the North Carolina state and has several offices around the state. He has practiced for over 20 years and has practiced and litigated in several different forums in the region. Jeremy graduated with a BA from the Virginia Commonwealth University and received his JD from Campbell University School of Law. Lastly, Karen Lucas is the director of a joint program project of the American Immigration Council and AILA, called the Immigration Justice Campaign, which is a project that has pulled together the interest of lawyers around the country to volunteer and assist with individuals who are facing removal primarily. We have programs in six different cities across the country partnering with local organizations to provide legal services for people who are in detention. Karen has worked at AILA as the Associate Director for Advocacy at the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, and she's a graduate from Georgetown University Law Center and Princeton University. So with those introductions, I'm going to pass it over to Judge Tabador.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you to everyone for joining us this afternoon. As Greg mentioned, I'm the president of National Association of Immigration Judges, and since I am speaking on behalf of NAIJ and not as an immigration judge, I need to be very clear, and this is part of our agreement with the department, is that I'm not a spokesperson for them, and that anything I say is a based on my personal opinion that has been gathered from discussions with our members and our board. So please do not attribute anything I say to the Department of Justice. And that's actually a good way to start because, you know, the Department of Justice makes us be very clear and public that we're not speaking on their behalf. And yet recently, the Department of Justice made a statement that the NAIJ has been in agreement with the department about the imposition of IJ quotas and deadlines as part of our individual performance measures. We are very disheartened by DOJ's mischaracterization of NAIJ's position on this issue. NAIJ has never agreed that imposition of quotas and deadlines on judges is an appropriate means of measuring a judge's performance. In fact, the very concept is in conflict with independent decision-making authority of judges because it pits the judge's personal livelihood to the mere completion of cases faster through the system rather than making decisions that are based on the facts and the law of the case as they took the oath to do. Moreover, quotas and deadlines that have been announced are frankly unreasonable. The department claims that the quotas that have been announced means the judges need to complete about 3 cases a day. We're not sure how they have arrived at this number. Our own calculations show that it's perhaps closer to 4 or maybe 5 cases a day. But even taking their own numbers, this means that they are allocating on average for a case no more than 2.5 hours for its entire life, which means that asylum cases that often have hundreds of pages of supporting documents, hours of testimony, deliberation, the time to issue a decision, all of that is allotted about 2.5 hours for beginning to end. Clearly, this is not justice. As to the department's other claim that judges are averaging about 680 cases or completions a year, that too is very problematic. Let me begin by saying that, frankly, we're not quite sure what they're basing their numbers on because to date they have not provided a definition of what would be considered a completion in their data. But again, even counting their own numbers, this means that at least half the judges would be failing that performance metrics on day one. Moreover, applying a singular number to judges who hear a wide latitude of cases is clearly unreasonable. Many people may not appreciate that our judges hear cases in a detained setting, in a non-detained setting. It can involve high-volume courts or cases that involve complex issues that can take, if not days. We deal with respondents, people who are unaccompanied children, with people who have mental competency issues, with people who have serious criminal convictions, and with people who have fear of returning to their home countries in case of threat of death. So quotas and deadlines compromise the judicial independence and the fundamental fairness that the judges have been sworn to uphold for the parties here before them. And it is going to invite unnecessary scrutiny and undermine the very integrity of the court. The parties who appear before the court will be wondering, is the judge issuing the decision because she's trying to meet a deadline or a quota, or is she really applying her impartial adjudicative powers? It is essentially building an appealable issue into the case, which means that instead of reducing the backlog, it is going to increase the backlog. We have had similar attempts at quote-unquote streamlining, focusing on efficiency over quality before. It happened shortly after 9/11 with the Attorney General Ashcroft's attempts to get rid of the backlog before the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the appellate body overseeing the judges. And they created a streamline mechanism that pushed all the cases, cleared a backlog, but pushed the cases into the Court of Appeals, and several years later, much of those cases came back and further exacerbated the backlog before the court. The problem is this takes years for it to really come to fruition, and oftentimes the individuals responsible for instituting those policies are not there to be held accountable, but the people who've been left behind to speak up for them will be left with the responsibility for it. Now, judges are aware of backlogs. We've been living with them for many, many years, and we are just as committed as anyone else to try to reduce these backlogs. We are in our courts 4.5 or 5 days a week. We're in court morning and afternoon. We have double, triple, quadruple cases scheduled so that no time is wasted. We didn't cause the backlog. The GAO study that was conducted supports that position. It found that close to 90% of the continuances were not attributed to the judge because, frankly, there are so many other factors that are outside the control of the judge that contribute to the question of fairness that it cannot be the judge's fault. In fact, when you look at what contributed to the backlog, you will see the two primary causes. One is lack of sufficient resources being allocated to the courts. When law enforcement gets 400% increases in their budget and the court gets only 70% increase, the only result you can expect is a bottleneck service with a backlog. And combine that with mismanagement of our dockets from one administration to the other, that contributes to the backlog. Our dockets have been used as a political tool, regardless of which administration is in power, and this constant docket reshuffling, constant reprioritization of cases has only helped to increase the backlog. So the answer is very clear. We need to protect the independence of our judges. We need to protect the integrity of our court. We need to recognize that this fundamental flaw with having the immigration court in a Department of Justice, which is a law enforcement agency, has now come to its end. We need to move the department, we need to move the immigration court out of the Department of Justice and create an independent court and ensure that the judges are given the true protection of being an independent decision maker. So I'm going to stop my remarks at this point, and I invite questions at the end of the other speaker's presentation.
Thank you, Judge Tapador. Before I pass it over to Jerry McKinney, I'm just going to mention, since Judge Tapador referenced the idea of an independent court, that this past year, AILA's Board of Governors passed a resolution that recommends now the creation of an independent immigration court system under Article 1, so that can be found on our website. And I'm now going to pass it over to Jeremy McKinney.
Thanks, Greg. Again, my name is Jeremy McKinney, and I'm the current AILA Secretary. Make no mistake, the outcome this administration truly desires from mandating quotas on an understaffed adjudicatory agency with a needlessly overstuffed docket is to transform it into a deportation machine. All of us, EOIR, the immigration judges, ICE, AILA, and our clients, we all agree that there's a problem. The EOIR backlog has now grown to almost 685,000 cases. However, this administration is only looking to address the problem by stripping judges of their independence and abridging each individual's right to a full and fair hearing before an impartial judge. Now, this move only guarantees more, not less, litigation and would not meaningfully impact the backlog. Now, why would this not impact the backlog? Because every action this administration has taken thus far has made the backlog worse and not better. Starting from the very beginning, January of 2017, the president rescinded ongoing efforts at smarter immigration enforcement, making virtually anyone present in the United States without authorization, that's a population of 10 to 11 million, priorities for deportation. Last year, ICE arrests of non-criminals, people without a criminal record, were up 300%. The more people in deportation that lack a criminal record but do have deep family and community ties, that equals more people who have a viable case to remain in the United States. That's more cases for immigration judges to hear and more strain on this court system. During the spring and summer of 2017, immigration judges around the nation were pulled from their courts to do details at the border at the request of this president. Many judges reported at the time that they didn't have a lot to do. Border arrests were actually down in 2017, and net migration with Mexico has steadily been at or near zero. And those departures away from their courts created more strain. Starting last summer and continuing up until now, ICE and their attorneys have started opposing all motions to administratively close or terminate pending deportation cases, even for the most vulnerable members of our society, abused or abandoned children, victims of violent crime, and even those who want to pursue legal avenues to remain in the United States, such as pursuing a waiver so the person can actually leave this country and apply for a visa. We've also seen an increase in clients being forced to apply for their residency before immigration judges. These were cases in the past were routinely terminated and sent to the United States and Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. More cases equals more strain on this court system. Yet, starting in July with a memo from the chief immigration judge, continuing in December with a memo from the attorney general, we are only seeing principles that point the finger at our clients and at attorneys, that we're the problem with the backlog, that we're creating this through applying for relief from deportation, and that there is a national interest in adjudicating immigration cases faster. So the focus is entirely on quick deportations, not on a national interest in maybe not separating families or a national interest in extending protection to those that are fleeing persecution and torture. It's all about speed, regardless of the strain this is putting on our court system. In January, we saw the release of performance goals. Now, at first, these were characterized as court-based goals instead of the monitoring of individual IJs. For example, a goal was to have a non-detained matter completed within 1 year. And yet, due to the current number of people ICE is placing into deportation, it takes months. I'm in North Carolina, and Charlotte takes 7 months before a matter can even be scheduled for the first initial hearing. And, of course, that's more strain on this court system. Finally, in January and March, the Attorney General referred two removal cases to himself, questioning whether immigration judges should have the power to administratively close cases or even grant continuances to allow a person to pursue a legal immigration benefit. That is less immigration independence and more strain on the system. These new quotas, which were released last week, are detached from reality. As I've outlined above, the rapid growth and reach of ICE has far outpaced the finite resources of EOIR, and judges are being stripped of independence at the exact same time that ICE is putting anyone it can get its hands on into deportation, and ICE lawyers have been commanded to no longer be merciful in cases that can and should be terminated or administratively closed. Now, we at AILA, we want to keep the focus on each individual's right to a full and fair hearing. We are concerned of the impact new quotas will have on a beleaguered IJ Corps. We are concerned about the lack of attention to ICE's ability to alleviate swollen dockets. Certainly, this EOIR has an interest in pushing back on ICE. We here at AILA will continue to engage with EOIR on steps which will improve efficiency and uphold due process, including the fast-tracking of an electronic filing system, preserving and protecting smart docket control practices such as administrative closure, and promoting the right to legal representation, especially for vulnerable communities such as children and the mentally incompetent. Meanwhile, this entire episode is another reminder for Congress that our country needs an independent immigration court system. We have one for tax. We have one for bankruptcy. Aren't the stakes higher here? Thank you, and I'll be happy to take your questions at the end.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I'm going to pass it over now to Karen Lucas of the Immigrant Justice Campaign.
Thanks, Greg. So I just wanted to also provide some important context here that the quotas are being imposed on top of a system that already lacks certain basic procedures to ensure a fair hearing, and that includes a right to legal counsel if you cannot afford one. And this is felt particularly acutely by detained immigrants. Nationally, only 14% of detained immigrants have legal counsel with them at their hearing. They are detained very often, not in major cities where there are lots of lawyers, but in remote locations that are far from family or metropolitan areas. And so the quotas will make an already unfair process even more so, especially for detained individuals. And so there are some really crucial things that need to happen in a case that sometimes needs some time. One is securing evidence needed to substantiate your claim. A judge is going to look at that. Often it's documents from overseas that take time to get, documentation from hospitals in other countries to document your persecution claim, for example. Or sometimes you have to wait for an independent mental health evaluation to substantiate your claim, but it's extremely hard to get timely clearance for doctors to get into detention centers. And so sometimes a continuance can be a lifeline to get that last piece of proof. Also, obtaining interpreters, especially in rare or indigenous languages. Lawyers who do this work day in and day out know how not uncommon it is for an asylum hearing to have to be stopped in the middle and recalendared because it becomes obvious to everyone in the room midstream that the interpretation is wholly inadequate. And then the last thing, perhaps most important, is you need time to find legal counsel, especially if you're detained. Detained immigrants who have representation are 10 times more likely to prevail in their cases, 10 times. And so forcing immigrants to move forward without an attorney eliminates a meaningful chance at a fair day in court. And because the need for attorneys to do this work is greater than it has ever been before, AILA, which is the National Bar Association for Immigration Attorneys, and the American Immigration Council, which is its nonprofit partner that uses research and litigation and advocacy to advocate for a fair and just immigration process, came together to build an immigration justice campaign, which is what I work on. And our goal was to focus on this access to justice gap for detained immigrants by strengthening the removal defense bar with new tools to get them ready for the challenges ahead, to engage a broader network of pro bono partners to help represent detained individuals who couldn't otherwise afford or obtain representation, and to amplify individual casework through national advocacy and litigation strategies. And through this work, through the cases that we're representing, we know firsthand that not having time to obtain a lawyer can impact real people. One client, for example, who just recently won asylum, was detained for 4 months before he was finally able to obtain a lawyer through our initiative. That's 4 months before he could get an attorney to represent him. He had a strong asylum case. He's a gay man who was persecuted in his home country because of his sexuality. He had been beaten repeatedly. The police did nothing. And then his partner was murdered. He came to the U.S. fearing for his life, and he was incarcerated until he was able to secure counsel. These are truly life and death cases, as this client's story demonstrates, and life or death cases should never be decided on a rushed assembly line. That's not justice. So thanks very much, and I'm happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you so much, Karen, and also to Judge Tabador and Jerry McKinney. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Catherine, the moderator, to take our first call. As she's queuing up the first call, I'll just mention that we are recording this on audio and can send that out to you. And Judge Tappador needs to be off the call in about 10 minutes. If you're unable to ask a question that you have for her, you can certainly send it to us, and we'll make sure to put you in touch with her. Catherine, would you give us the first question, please?
Absolutely. So at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone telephone. And we will go ahead and get started with our first question from Pilar Marrero with La Opinión. And your line is open.
Okay, thank you so much. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having this call. I was wondering if Judge Tappador can speak a little bit more, if she's still on the call, about what happened after 9/11 and how the measures taken then affected people's due process. And I have a second question regarding how this whole thing may impact judge retirement.
Thank you. So after 9/11, there was a great, a lot of attention that was paid to backlog, and there was a lot of emphasis placed on how to get rid of the backlog. And one of the sort of proposed answers was to create a streamlined process for the Board of Immigration Appeals to review immigration judge decisions and do what was called sort of a one-line affirmance without opinion, or just reverse and send down. And what that did was to allow for the board members to go through the backlog much quicker, and it then undermined the at least the appearance that the litigants were getting a full review of their case because they didn't know what the board members had considered. And it created a large amount of litigation in circuit court, which then resulted in many of those cases being sent back and having to be done again. Since it took, again, a number of years, but ultimately then the streamline process was rescinded and the board stopped using that process. So I will stop my answer on that one, and for more information, you can certainly follow up with me. In terms of, I think if I understand your question on retirement,
yeah,
we have about 40% of our judge corps that are retirement eligible, and we are seeing a very large percentage of them putting in for retirement because of these pressures. Before, people would stay and continue to work for many years after they were retirement eligible, but we're seeing now that people who become retirement eligible, they're much more likely to retire than to stay on under the pressures that have been posed on them.
Thanks, Your Honor.
Next question, then. Operator, do we have any other questions in the queue?
Yes, our next question is from Ian DeChiara with CQ Roll Call. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. I just had a quick question, and anyone can answer it, but if the judge has a minute, I'd appreciate it. Also in the memo, in addition to the quotas, there are time constraints on how often certain cases should be adjudicated, and you spoke a little about how that could contribute to the backlog, and I was just wondering if you could expand on whether you think that there would be an effect on overall, or if that would drive case completion numbers up, because as you mentioned, there were some figures on case completion that DOJ has put out that you guys don't quite agree with. And if you have a number, an average case completion number that you guys operate on, if you could share that with us too. Thank you.
All right, so I think it's a two-part question. On the first part, you're focusing on what I understand to be the deadline portion of this quotas and deadlines performance measures. And we do have grave concerns about the deadline portion as well, because I think that's a much more direct intrusion into the independent decision-making of the judge. For example, if you look at the second to the last one, it says 95% of all cases, individual merits hearing is completed on the initial scheduled hearing date. So what this is saying is that in the vast, vast majority of cases, there's an expectation that the case be completed on the very first day that is set for trial. Now, again, as I mentioned, we are backlogged. Judges are double, triple, quadruple booked. Oftentimes, there are things outside the control of the judge that requires that the judge, as a matter of fundamental fairness and due process, to continue the case. We do not know what they're basing these numbers on. We've never been given the data to support whether this is something that has been accomplished. Anecdotally, we're not aware that this is a number that is even close to being reasonable, again, based on the backlog we've had and the mechanism that the judges are using in order to make sure that there's always some sort of a backup case that is available for them to hear. The other problem is that, you know, if you take a look at the 100% of credible fear and reasonable fear reviews are to be completed on the initial hearing date, it's not even allowing for any exceptions. All of those go to the heart of the judge's ability to be able to determine whether someone deserves to have a continuance under the law based on the judge's independent decision-making authority. The person shows up and has a heart attack or has a serious issue, or they are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and have a difficult time at that hearing expressing themselves and need an opportunity to be able to gather evidence and find a way to present their case in another opportunity. So these are the fundamental queries that we have, or questions and concerns that we have. As for the numbers, as I said, we're not sure what they're basing these completion averages on. First of all, by definition, average means that you're dumping everything into one pot and then dividing it up by the number of people. And that's a fundamentally flawed way of looking at this, because we have people who are in a disability, maybe hearing a maybe larger volume of cases due to the nature of the demographics that are going into those courts, people with very serious criminal issues or people with very limited ties to the United States. And then you have on the other side people who have non-detained cases, a large backlog of people who've been here for a long period of time, and the cases can take a much longer period of time to complete. So even that methodology from our perspective is problematic. Moreover, we don't know what definition of completion that the government is using. The last we heard, it included what are called administrative closures. And our understanding is that perhaps in the future, administrative closures will not be counted, or at a minimum, based on the recent developments in the AG certification process, it may not even be available. So once you remove a certain set of cases that were previously considered a completion, and now it's no longer considered a completion, will be problematic. In terms of how we reach the 4 to 5 days, you got to take out all the, you have to focus on all the days where the court is closed, where we have training, where there is, let's say, sick leave, there's master calendar time. So if you take a look at, if you take all of those out and you actually focus on trial days and then divvy that up by the number of sessions that a court would have and how many cases would need to be finished to meet that, that's how you come up with the 4 to 5 rather than the 3. But regardless of what number you look at, 3, 4, or 5, this completely is problematic because it doesn't take into consideration the specific facts and the law of the case that the judge should be focusing on. I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Did anybody else want to take a crack at that question?
This is Jeremy McKinney. Just to piggyback on the judge's comments, a lot of cases, especially difficult asylum cases, are reserved. The administrative record is closed, but a decision is sometimes postponed several weeks away or several months away, so that the immigration judge can go through what is routinely a very complex record, again, where there are life or potentially life and death consequences. So not understanding what EOR means by completion is troubling because does that mean a case where a judge takes the testimony but then wants to review this record again before rendering a decision, that judge would otherwise be forced to go ahead and make a decision on his or her memory of this complex record instead of taking the time and working with a clerk to meaningfully review the administrative record. Again, the result there is going to be a lack of due process for our clients.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Moderator, next question. I don't know how much longer we have Judge Tabador on the line, but go ahead.
And our next question comes from Louis LeBrec with Bloomberg Live. Your line is open at this time.
Hello, this is Louis LeBrec from Bloomberg Law. I was calling, and my question is for Ashley. Could you please, I guess you mentioned that you disagreed with what the Justice Department said about the idea that the union agreed to the new production quotas. I guess what they said was that the production quotas were banned by the former collective bargaining agreement, but that the new one doesn't include that ban. That's the way that they're suggesting that you may have agreed. I was wondering how you would respond to that. And also wanted to ask about the...
Let me just answer that because I was literally running out the door when
Okay.
So again, as I said, it's a mischaracterization of NAIJ's position. Because of this duality that we're forced to live in, which is we are judges on the one hand and we're also federal government employees on the other hand, we have very limited rights as federal government employees in asserting our concerns about what's called management rights to set standards. So when we had negotiated in the past with the department regarding these performance measures, they had always agreed that quotas and deadlines would be absolutely in conflict with a judge's independent decision-making authority. And so to give us assurance, they had agreed to put that prohibition in our contract or labor contract. But what this administration did as very first act was to reopen negotiations on those articles and demanded that that prohibition be taken out. And because under the labor law, as federal government employees, we do not have a right to negotiate on that, we had no choice but to agree to that. But from day one, we had said we believe it's absolutely inconsistent to apply quotas and deadlines on judges who are supposed to exercise independent decision-making authority, and that we have been in disagreement with them from day one. So this is a grave mischaracterization of NAIJ's position.
Okay, so to follow up, what you're saying then is that you didn't have the ability to
the ability to fight back. Our hands are tied because we are considered federal government employees, have no right under labor law to in any way challenge their position on that in setting those metrics. But we have never agreed to it.
Got it. And I also want to ask about the other things that you talked about, which were the kind of questioning the number of cases that they came up with.
Judge Tabador has to leave, so we're getting off the call now. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
What you can do is to send your questions to our team. I think Bell Woods is the best point of contact, and we can make sure that Judge Tabador gets the question.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Moderator, next question, please.
And our next question comes from Evan Grohl with Vice News. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks again for having the call. And a bit of a simplistic question, so bear with me. I'm just curious, could you spell out simply how exactly it's going to increase the backlog? I get a sense of the appeals coming back and that taking more time, but could you just give me a better sense of how the quotas and deadlines are going to increase the backlog?
Well, if you look at how they will increase the backlog, is that we believe that it's just going to result in more legal challenges and more litigation. So that you're, in essence, taking the problem from one portion of the agency and just diverting it to another. And what the judge pointed out earlier was the transition that we saw in the past from past backlogs going from the immigration judge, the trial level, to the Board of Immigration Appeals, to the circuit courts, and then back to the board. So in that way, quotas, because they are such a point of contention, we feel that they're going to create more litigation and not less. But, you know, my basic point and Ayla's basic point is that this quotas are a wrong way to go about solving this backlog. That you can look in, there are ways out there that promote due process and improve efficiency. And then fundamentally, when you've got an agency out of control with putting people into proceedings at a rate that far outpaces the resources of the court system, you create that bottleneck. And that's going to make the backlog worse. And what we've seen every month when TRAC at Syracuse issues new numbers, we're not seeing the numbers go down. We're seeing the backlog continue to grow and grow and grow, despite the fact that the new administration has really tried to outpace previous administrations with immigration judge hirings.
Makes perfect sense. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks. Catherine, moderator, any additional questions?
Yes. Our next question is from Martha Dalton with WABE. Your line is now open.
Thank you for taking my question. Jeremy, just to follow up on what you were saying, if quotas won't reduce the backlog, you mentioned that there are other ways to do it. What would work, actually? I mean, is it hiring more judges? What would actually help reduce it?
Well, first of all, we have to look at their resources. I know that this may seem a bit in the weeds, but this agency literally still does its job on paper. I know it may sound like a small thing, but actually fast-tracking an electronic filing system would create huge efficiency, because both with judges' ability to get motions faster and resolve motions faster, but also to actually view what is often hundreds of pages of evidence on a screen during the hearing. It's much easier to navigate. The courts recently got digital audio recording. That's something that came about during this decade. Previously, it was cassettes. And so starting out with, let's modernize the current system. Secondly, I hear complaints from my colleagues that are immigration judges often as to the lack of support that they have in terms of the number of clerks. You often see one clerk being shared amongst three different judges. And you go into these judges' offices and you just see piles and piles of files that are cases waiting decision, because they need that kind of the legal and clerical assistance to get those decisions out. So they need better resources. And then the Attorney General, at the same time that he wants the cases to move faster, is doing everything he can to get rid of smart docket control practices. Administrative closure is a pause button on a removal proceeding so that the individual can pursue a legal avenue of relief outside of the court. That's one less case that the court has to hear. If someone has been a victim of domestic violence and is pursuing what's called a U visa, that's something a judge can't grant. It's only something that USCIS can grant. And so does it make sense to have that case on the docket when another agency is ultimately going to determine in many of these cases whether the person can remain in the United States? Why go after that? The only answer to that is that you just want people to get deported faster. But that is going to create more litigation, because that person that has that that approvable petition pending with USCIS who has suddenly been ordered deported by an immigration judge, that person is not going to just sit back. That person is going to appeal. And that person is going to remain here while that appeal is pending. So we're just piling up litigation instead of solving the problem.
Thank you, Jeremy. And just having that walkthrough of the challenges of the immigration court system's efficiencies, and I love your metaphor, or not metaphor, but the historic reference to the use of cassettes for recordings, and it made me think, are we talking A-track? Are we talking, you know, other cassettes? Just to show the inefficiencies. One other thing I'll just mention is that the lack of guaranteed counsel paid for by the government for individuals who can't pay for counsel is another thing that very much slows down cases. Frequently, and actually the most frequent reason individuals request continuances when they appear in their hearings before judges is because they do not have counsel yet and they are looking for counsel but are unable to find one. And if you ask judges across the board, they will say how having counsel speeds up the process because lawyers understand, you know, what next steps are required of people that are appearing, how to prepare their cases, so they actually help make the system more efficient while also ensuring due process for the people that are appearing before the judges.
Can I quickly follow up with you on that? How would that need to happen? I mean, that seems like it might be procedural or something. I mean, how would that occur? How would you get a guaranteed counsel?
Thank you for asking that question. So there's a couple of steps to this. First of all, there is no statutory guarantee right now for paid counsel. So in order for that to be a guarantee under law, we would need Congress to pass statute. For many years, the Department of Justice has had programs that have facilitated access to counsel. Some of them are programs that provide information and education about the immigration law system. Some of those programs continue to operate. There were also some initial pilot programs that were in operation a few years ago that did pair up people, provide actual paid for counsel for vulnerable, highly vulnerable groups of individuals like children or the incompetent. Those were just in the pilot stages. I do not think those have continued to operate, although I don't have a very recent update on where those programs stand. But the Department of Justice does have the authority to run either access to counsel programs to facilitate that legal education or to help assist with matching attorneys with respondents, and also has the authority to set up funded programs with the current legal structure. I do not think those funded programs have continued under the Department of Justice now. Other questions, Catherine, in the queue?
Yes, our next question is with Estelita Carazay from Folia, Sao Paulo. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you for having this call. I just wanted to check if this immigration court system and all the problems, the backlog that you've been mentioned, has this impact the ICE detention centers over the country? Have you seen an increase overcrowded detention centers? What's the current situation of those detainees?
Karen, Jeremy, which of you would like to take this?
Sure, this is Karen. So what we're definitely seeing is an expansion of detention. I know that the most recent budget that was passed included additional funding for even more detention beds. And so, you know, the increased reliance on detention is a huge due process problem, and it limits your access to legal information, it limits your access to counsel. And very often individuals who are detained are subjected to expedited removal processes that bypass immigration courts and have even greater due process problems. So we are seeing an increasing resort to detention.
Thank you.
Our next question will come from Reed Levinson with Reuters. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. This might be more of a question for Judge Tabador, so if Jeremy or you or Karen don't have an answer, then that's fine. I can send an email. But my question is whether there's been any clarity on how these quotas will apply retroactively to judges and what sort of consequences judges might face if they, you know, get an unsatisfactory performance rating or don't meet these quotas and benchmarks.
Yeah, that's a great question for the judge because, we don't even have clarity on what a case completion even means, and there seems to be significant disagreement between EOIR and the union. So I certainly don't know if it's going to apply retroactively. I know that these are scheduled to begin on October 1st, in other words, the first day of the fiscal year of the fiscal year 2019.
The only other comment that I would add, this is Greg Chen, is that there was some ambiguity in the language of the materials that came from your Executive Office for Immigration Review as to whether before October 1st, any of these quotas would have any effect, or if they would even put some pressure on the judges to try to finish up the year under the quotas. That's still a question that's out there, asking either EOIR itself or NAIJ for clarification, I think, would be your best source. But I think that is ambiguous in the documents. Moderator?
And our next question comes from Diane Solis with Dallas Morning News. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the electronic filing system. Is there anything that is now electronically filed? Anything at all? Or do you communicate totally by email?
Not by email. I'd actually love to communicate by email with the court. Right now, there's what's called an e-registry system, and that is to submit a notice of appearance. So you can electronically submit a form called a G-28 that says, I am this person's attorney. That is all. And now, we know that, or at least the director has expressed, the EOIR director has expressed an interest in fast-tracking electronic filing, but we don't know, whether or when we're going to see the fruits of that labor. But literally everything is on paper. If I need to file a motion with the court, just a motion to appear telephonically or a motion to continue a case, it is, I hit the printer and I put it in a FedEx and send it to the court and copy the other side, DHS, in that way. So what you often get, and this works both ways, is you often get an order from the judge granting or denying the motion on the same day that you get a copy of the notice that a motion was filed. It's a very, very strange, very antiquated, but also this is the reality that these IJAs have to deal with every day.
Okay. And is that why we often see the prosecutors from ICE or DHS come in hauling what's basically a shopping cart of paper files?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Moderator, we are approaching the hour here of 2:30. Unfortunately, this is Greg Jen, I need to sign off, but Bell Woods can continue the moderation. So let's take the next question, but Bell Woods will resume the moderation here of any further questions after. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for joining. Feel free to go as long as we can take the questions.
We do have an additional question from Jamie Ganey with Diversity, Inc. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for doing the call. I have a couple of questions. I'll try to make them short. Just as a statement, rather, this seems rather unethical, the position that the judges are being put in, by a law enforcement agency when this is supposed to be a neutral process. But my question, or one of my questions, is does anyone have any idea of the demographics or demographic information for immigration judges? Is that located anywhere where we might know a little bit about the people that are being asked to follow these quotas.
This is Karen. That's a great question, and I don't know where that information would be available, but we can take a look and send you a follow-up.
The EOR website has a brief bio of the immigration judges, but you know, it is very, you know, will tell you the person's professional background, and that's about the extent of it.
Get some, because obviously the folks that are in these positions, you know, I can speculate that some of them do represent different groups outside of, you know, the professional realm, and may be a little conflicted with being put in this position, given their own personal demographics. But if that information exists anywhere, I'd love to get it. My second question is sort of partially answered already, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I'm just hoping that maybe we're all wrong. I understand that because folks are federal employees, that their hands are tied, but what if any, are plans exist to advocate for some type of policy change? Are there any partnerships outside of these organizations represented on this call to sort of have discussions and take a look at all the numerous issues, because you guys brought up many issues, but are there any, you know, politicians, are there any ideas about how to move forward, you know, given the fact that, you know, hands are tied? Are there allies anywhere that that are, you know, sort of saying the same thing that you guys are at this point?
So this is Karen. I can give that a start. Yes, there are great allies, both nationally and locally. Just with our immigration justice campaign, we have local partners as well as national partners who are, you know, with us in the fight for a fair day in court, and in a fight for access to counsel and access to justice for detained immigrants. And the American Immigration Council uses research and systemic litigation and policy analysis and communication strategies to advocate for these things. And so, yes, there are wonderful partners across the country, and we always need more.
Thank you. I think that answered most of my questions. It's just a general question to everybody. Are there opportunities to follow up with additional questions with each one of you? I'm not sure what that would look like, but I don't want to take up the entire time of asking questions that I have if I can have one-on-one conversations with anyone on the panel.
Sure. Hi, Jamie. This is Belle Woods from AILA. I'd be more than happy to connect you with the panelists after the call is over to schedule individual interviews. And actually, both Jeremy and Karen do have to step off now. So if anyone else has additional questions, please feel free to send them to me. You should all have my email, because I think I gave you all the contact information to get on the call. But bwoods@aila.org is that email address. And we really appreciate all of you for calling in. Thanks so much.